from cracking psychologically. For Balma, she was more than just a counselor checking in on his mental health, though. The promise of a future with Holly was enough to keep him fighting. The way she smiled at him over breakfast in the ship's mess, her hand in his while they strolled through the agricultural biome, their passionate moments shared in their birth. It all hit Balma like an organic sentinel on the charge. He couldn't lose her like this. Footsteps exploded down the corridor behind him. "Balma!" a voice called. "We're coming!" Emmanuel rushed in with Diego close behind. Ort, too, appeared in the doorway, blocking it with his massive frame. "What can we do?" Ort asked. Emmanuel examined the wound on Holly's head. "We need to get her to the med bay." Balma began to unstrap her. Her head lolled to the side. "Careful with her neck," Emmanuel said. "She might be hurt." Balma, Diego, and Emmanuel gingerly unstrapped Holly the rest of the way. Then Emmanuel helped Balma carry her by her shoulders as Ort followed in the rear holding her legs. Balma was only vaguely aware of the bluish cylinders where Sophie, Jamie, and Owen were being kept in cryostasis when they entered the medical bay. They still had no idea whether Sophie would make a full recovery or not. He'd seen the pain it caused Emmanuel, and he feared he was about to experience that same horrible feeling. But as they set Holly down on a patient bed, her eyelids fluttered. Balma swallowed hard, careful not to let his hope carry him away. "Holly," he caressed her arm.
Where am I?" she asked. "We're in the med bay," Balma replied.
He fought to hold in his emotion.
"She's awake. Alive. Oh, thank God."
A dark realization passed over him like a sudden storm cloud.
"Do you know who I am?"
She cracked a half grin like he had said the dumbest thing in the world.
"Of course I do, Chad."
A small twinge of relief settled through him at the sound of his first name.
"Do you know where we're headed?" "Mars."
Then a sudden look of worry crossed her face. She brushed at the blood dripping down her forehead.
"Unless something else happened. We're still going to Mars, right?"
"Something did happen," Emmanuel said. He had disappeared when they'd arrived in the med bay and now came to the bed carrying bandages and antiseptics. He started dressing her wound. "We're on Mars now. Crash landed."
"And the drones?" she asked.
"Still in space as far as we can tell," Ort rumbled. "Seems like those bastards think they got us."
"Then we've got something to show them," Diego said.
Balma wanted to share in their bravado, but for now, he could only focus on Holly.
"God, I'm so glad you're alive."
He swallowed her in an embrace. Then he pulled back.
"You scared the shit out of me. Please don't do that again."
Holly laughed.
"Trust me, I don't want to."
She rubbed the freshly set bandage.
"I could use something for my head."
"On it,"
Emmanuel said, navigating over the tilted deck. He started rummaging through the supplies.
"We might be stuck here for a little while until we figure out what's next."
He grabbed a bottle and studied the label.
"How are we doing on supplies, Sonia?"
Balma massaged Holly's hand, sharing a smile with her. He realized in that moment how hard he would fight to help her and the others. Nothing they had accomplished so far had been easy, but it had all been worth the effort. The sooner they got moving and found Hoffman's colony, the better he'd feel.
"We have enough basic medical supplies for approximately 60 years' worth of normal activities with occasional disasters,"
Sonia said, responding to Emmanuel's query. Balma breathed a sigh of relief.
"Unfortunately, we took heavy damage to the cargo hold,"
Sonia continued.
"Our water supplies were also substantially damaged. In addition, the cryostat fluid tanks are leaking. At best, you have enough supplies to last a week."
"That gives us some time to come up with a plan," Balma said. It still wasn't a comfortable timeline, but it would do.
He noticed Emmanuel looking toward Sophie's tube.
"What about the cryostat fluid?" Emmanuel asked. "If there's no more fluid to run the cryo chambers, we will have to take Jamie and Owen out."
Bauma knew the children were mostly healthy and would be fine. Sophie, on the other hand, their final stand on Earth to get on the sunspot had ended with her succumbing to massive convulsions. He didn't understand the medical condition perfectly, but what he did know was that she had been infected with organic nanobots. Those bots were teeming in her bloodstream. They had nearly killed her when she'd been forced to activate the R-Vamp, the blast acting on the bots within her. "How long until we run out?" Emmanuel asked, looking up at one of the screens. Sonia paused, as if trying to show concern for her human companions, Bauma thought wryly.
48 hours.
Chapter 3. Their shields are weak, Walker said. You can tell by the color. Athena had noticed that when she first saw the spiders. Just because the shields were weak didn't mean she could necessarily take them down with her pulse rifle, though. She carried two of the remaining four electromagnetic pulse, EMP, grenades in the GOA's arsenal, but the precious weapons were too valuable to use unless absolutely necessary. "Stick to the original plan," Athena whispered. Walker hesitated, then slowly lowered his MP5. She could tell he wanted to fight, but they needed to be smart. She glanced out the third-story window of their hiding spot, an apartment building 2 blocks from the tower. The spiders were still out there searching for their prey.
Scratch, scrape, scratch, scrape.
The sounds of their razor-sharp claws echoed through the city, sending a chill up her spine. She pulled away from the window. There were still several hours of daylight left. She didn't want to be out here in the dark. That was when the other beasts came out to hunt. Athena and her crew had never seen one of them in person. The only person that had was Corporal Justin Marlin. He had reported hearing a whistling sound and described the sand glowing blue on a night patrol outside the buried submarine. The last thing he had said was rooted in her memory. "The seabed is blue again. It's blue. All of it. Glowing blue." They had found his corpse a few days later. Nothing but mummified remains. Whatever creature had killed him had done so by sucking the water from his flesh like some sort of vampire alien. Since then, Athena had kept their missions to the daylight. The thought reminded her they couldn't stay here forever. They had to get to that tower and transmit to Alexia. The AI's promise of a plan was the only thing keeping Athena's ragtag crew going.
"Come on, let's see if we can flank them without being seen,"
she said, heading toward the door. They made their way back down through the building, taking a concrete stairwell to the lobby, where the remains of several orbs were plastered to the wood floor like macabre carpet. Heat haze rose off the concrete outside the broken windows of the lobby. Athena glanced at her HUD. It was 120 degrees Fahrenheit. Her suit continued to pump liquid coolant under the armor, but her flesh was slick with sweat. She resisted the urge to reach up and flip her visor so she could wipe her face and eyes clean. A single distraction could cost them their lives. Walker hurried across the room, his weapon shouldered. He halted in front of a missing window, his boots crunching the skirt of glass underneath. The crunch wasn't loud to a human ear, but it was loud enough for a spider to detect. Walker glanced back at Athena. She couldn't see his features behind his mirrored visor, but she knew he was likely cringing. For a split second, Athena thought the mistake might go unnoticed. But not today. A blue glow suddenly reflected off a shard of glass hanging from the window frame by Walker. Athena had just enough time to bring her pulse rifle up and aim at the spider, which was lowering itself down from a blue web. "Get down!" Athena shouted. Walker turned to face the beast as it hung from a thick blue string just outside the glassless window. It slashed at his armor, claws slicing through his chest plates. He stumbled and crashed to the ground, his rifle clanking to the floor. "Get up!" she yelled. He managed to push himself to his feet, but now he was directly in her line of fire.
The spider leapt into the room and struck Walker again, this time in the back, sending him spinning. He let out a cry of pain that was drowned out by her gunfire. The pulse bolts lanced into the spider's weak shield. A blue bubble flashed around the creature, the shield absorbing the bolts and holding. Athena choked on adrenaline as she fired again. Crawling toward her, Walker used his elbows to move his body across the floor, leaving a trail of blood behind him. The spider roared, mandibles parting above her dying comrade. Athena continued to pump rounds into its shield until one of them finally penetrated the creature's exoskeleton. The alien screeched in pain and raised two limbs into the air. Walker fumbled for his weapon, grabbed it, and moved onto his back to fire off his magazine. Blood exploded out of the alien's wounds, but the creature skittered right into the fire.
"No!"
Athena yelled. The alien impaled Walker through the gut with a claw, then lifted his skewered body off the ground. He grabbed the arachnid's limb, screaming in pain. Blood gushed around the wound as it raised Walker higher. The spider's shield was down now, giving Athena her chance. She strode forward and fired the rest of her magazine into the monster, riddling it with rounds. The alien dropped Walker with a thud. Athena ducked under the flailing beast and grabbed Walker by the back of his armor. She dragged him away, narrowly avoiding the whooshing claws. They didn't have much time before other creatures showed up. She would have to use an EMP grenade if they did. It was her only shot at making it out alive. But Walker was in bad shape. Blood gurgled from between his gloved fingers as she pulled him to safety. He reached up with his other hand and flipped his visor, sucking in a long gasp of air.
"Stop,"
he grumbled. Blood popped out of his mouth in an exploding bubble. She scanned the street outside. The spider was still moving on the floor, but it was too far away to pose much of a threat now.
"You gotta go,"
Walker said.
I'm done for."
She was already reaching into a pouch on her duty belt to get the coagulating cream that would stop the bleeding. He reached up and grabbed her armored wrist.
"I'll hold them off. You get that message from Alexia,"
he said. Athena shook her helmet.
"No, I'm not leaving you."
He cursed, grimaced, and closed his eyes, his features distorted in pain. The floor was slick with his blood, and crimson covered his suit. He was right. It was too late. He wasn't going to make it, no matter what she did.
"Give me my gun,"
he choked out. Athena scrambled over to the weapon, eyeing the spider limbs that were still slashing the air. She ducked down, grabbed it, and then moved back to Walker. She handed him the rifle and grabbed his other hand.
"I'll buy you,"
he coughed and then sucked in a breath. After an exhale, he said,
"I'll buy you some time."
Athena managed to nod, holding his gaze for a moment. Losing Walker would be losing their comedic relief. His humor and bravado had given them all precious moments of levity in their darkest moments. Now there would be only dark. She wouldn't let him die in vain.
"Go,"
he said. A tear fell from her eye. She pushed herself up, ran back into the hallway, and made her way toward the back door. When she reached the exit, she pushed it open and checked the street. It was clear, and the radio tower was just two blocks away. She set off on the sidewalk, changing her rifle's magazine as she ran. The crack of gunfire burst out behind her. Walker lasted several more minutes, just enough time for her to get to the tower before the din of the shots faded away. At the base of the tower, she threw the sling of her rifle over her back and pulled the communication device from her belt. Then she grabbed a rung, looked up, and started climbing.
Entry 10001, designee AI Alexia. I finish a scan of the robots I reconstructed. They are all actively patrolling the air ducts and other entries into the biosphere. The bots outside the mountain continue to scan for organics. None have spotted anything unusual. I checked the feed from JPP-1, a cleaning robot I've retrofitted with a video camera. The bot moves on tracks like a tank, crunching over the dry, rocky terrain around the mountain. Views of Colorado Springs show an increasingly brown and arid landscape. Spindly trees, yellow foliage, and sage tumbling across the cracked dirt are a common sight out there. I switch from the JPP-1's feed to the most advanced robot I still have access to, Lolo. The NTC satellite orbiting Earth is currently in a perfect position to observe the ships docked at the platform in the Atlantic. I'm calling this one Staging Area 19, as I've found more than 18 of these massive landing pads in what remains of the Earth's oceans. There are 24 drones patrolling the platform, all within the same combat interval of a quarter mile. It's quite remarkable how much security they have at these locations, considering the state of the human race. This tells me they are protecting something very important. But what I'm really interested in is the fighter jets sitting on the tarmac. I zoom in for a better look. Unlike most of the teardrop-shaped alien craft, these have two wings and a dorsal fin like some sort of predatory fish. There is a cockpit and doors on both the port and starboard sides. For the first time, I see the pilots. They are what the humans call sentinels, best described as a mix between a reptile and a human. Spiked tails slither behind thick torsos as the pilots walk around their aircraft, apparently waiting for orders. I wish I knew who was giving them. My best guess is that the multi-dimensional overlords have some sort of AI like myself that controls their minions. Perhaps they use the nanobots they infected Dr. Winston and Lieutenant Smith with? I continue watching while filtering through other feeds. A sensor detects an incoming transmission and I switch to the comm system. I'm overly cautious about transmissions due to the threat of organics hacking into my interface, but this one is legitimate. I trace it to the same location I sent to Athena 2 days earlier. The corporal is right on time.
I hope your intel is good, Alexia, she says. I lost a good man today to get here.
I'm sorry for your loss, corporal. It is hard for me to understand death even with my advanced programming, but I can tell by the tone of Athena's voice that this one has hit her hard. I've been working on finding a way off the planet for you and your crew, as well as other survivors scattered across the world. I've been in contact with multiple groups. One of them isn't far from your location, only about 120 miles at Pelican Air Force Base.
That's a hell of a long ways on foot through enemy territory, Athena says.
You won't have to go on foot. I'm sending you the coordinates of an underground parking facility 5 miles from your location, as well as the location of Pelican Air Force Base.
Wouldn't the pulse have knocked them out during the first day of the invasion?
It's possible some of the vehicles are deep enough below ground that they might still work.
What are the odds? Athena says. If I'm going to risk it, I want to know.
I put them at 49%.
Suppose we do manage to get some, and drive 120 miles to meet up with this other group of survivors. Then what?
I take a split second to look back at the images from Lolo. A sentinel climbs into the cockpit of an aircraft and takes off from the platform. By the time I respond to Athena, the fighter is soaring west over the draining ocean. I have a plan, I say, a plan that will get you off this planet and to Mars with the others. End entry.
Emmanuel stood at the front of the med bay. The air hissing through the ventilation ducts still carried the odor of charred plastic and hot metal. He couldn't bring himself to sit, like the others. Bauma, Ort, Diego, and Holly were seated at a table in the middle of the med bay, surrounded by empty patient beds. Visions of the cryostat fluid running out had filled his head with dark thoughts. All he could see were images of Sophie lying, gasping for air on the sunspot's deck. Jeff and David sat near the cryo chambers, as if guarding the other children. The duo had been bruised in the attack, but had come out of the crash otherwise okay. Bauma had already tried to usher them out of the med bay, but they'd insisted on staying. Jeff wanted to know what was going to happen next. Back on Earth, after they'd first found Jeff and David, Emmanuel might have demanded the kids leave the room so the adults could do the talking. He wanted to shield them as much as he could from the darkness plaguing their reality. But any innocence Jeff and David once had was left behind on Earth. They had done their duty defending the sunspot, and they deserved a place at the metaphorical table as much as any other crew member here. Pacing, Emmanuel stared at the cryo chamber where Sophie was suspended. She had always wanted to get to Mars. It had been her goal to make it to Hoffman's colony since the beginning. Emmanuel had promised her they would make it.
When he had loaded her into the chamber 3 months ago, he had thought he could actually make good on that promise. It turned out that he had indeed gotten her to Mars, but there was no way she'd live to see Hoffman's colony with the leaking cryostat tanks.
"We need to get to that crashed biosphere ship," Emmanuel said. "If we don't, Sophie dies. Tell me where and I'll head out," Balma said eagerly. Emmanuel nodded. "Good. We don't have time to lose."
Diego's gaze shifted as he looked to Emmanuel.
"We've got a hell of a deadline, but we've got to be realistic. Sonia said that ship is sending out some kind of damaged SOS. I don't think I need to explain what that means."
"Rushing into a ship that might be full of organics without a plan is not the best idea," Ord agreed.
Heat rushed to Emmanuel's face.
"We don't have a choice. Sophie is going to die if we don't get that cryostat fluid."
"Doc is right," Balma said.
"I won't dispute that," Diego said, holding his hands up. "But we've got to be rational. That other ship was knocked down by organics just like we were. We run in there to go get cryostat fluid for Sophie, we could all end up dead. That won't help her."
Emmanuel palmed the table.
"You want to just let her die?"
"Not at all," Diego said. "I'm just saying we've got to think this through. We can't sacrifice all of us for one of us.
Not if that also means sacrificing our mission of finding the rest of humanity on Mars. I'm all for launching a scavenging operation, but we need better intel before blindly leaping out there."
Ort let out a harumph of agreement.
"You're in charge of this mission, and I'll go out there if you order it," Diego continued. "But I want you to at least consider whether your judgment is being compromised by your relationship with Dr. Winston, or if you truly think this is the best thing for our mission."
Emmanuel stiffened. He took a deep breath and tried to revert to an expression of measured calmness.
"It's not just about Sophie. We also took heavy damage to the cargo hold. We need more food and water if any of us are going to survive."
Ort seemed to consider that for a moment.
"Sonia, can you give us an exact time frame on how long our remaining supplies will last?"
The AI's soothing voice answered back.
"If you follow the prescribed rationing plan I have created, 1 week is it. But if you stretch it an uncomfortable amount and do not mind some considerable physical discomfort, you can extend your survival to 3.5 weeks.
Diego gave Emmanuel a look that burned through his skull. The soldier said nothing. He didn't have to, and he knew it. Emmanuel pressed the heels of his palms into his eyes. He let out an exasperated breath. Maybe Diego was right. He was letting his feelings for Sophie affect his judgment. They were in enemy territory here. Hell, the whole solar system seemed to be enemy territory now. He and the others couldn't afford to act rashly. They would pay dearly for any mistakes. He turned away to recompose himself. There was so much at stake he could hardly focus, from Sophie's life to the future of humanity. He begrudgingly had to admit Diego wasn't entirely wrong. It was impossible for him to untangle Sophie's survival from his preferred course of action. But he owed it to Diego to hear the man out. After all, he was the only military officer among them.
"Tell me, Diego, how would you approach the situation?" Emmanuel asked.
"In a perfect world, I'd send out a couple of scouts. We'd observe the downed ship for 2 or 3 days.
"A couple of days is all Sophie has left." Emmanuel wanted to say it, but he bit back the words.
"We'd scout the area looking for signs of organics both inside and outside the ship, while identifying potential entry and exit points. If there were no organics, we'd go in. If there were organics, we'd track their numbers to see if it's a battle we could fight."
"And if it wasn't?"
Emmanuel asked.
"We'd look for a way to relieve the ship of supplies while avoiding organics."
Emmanuel slumped into a seat across from Diego.
"How long would all this take?"
Diego's eyes went up for a second as he tallied the numbers in his head.
"If we're quick, we can make a reasonable effort to scout the ship and come up with a good plan of incursion in 5, maybe even 4 days. Plenty of time, given our remaining supplies."
"But not enough time for Sophie."
Emmanuel stood up and walked away from the table.
"Look, I'll go out there alone.
I don't expect all of you to risk your lives for her, but I can't let her die. That wrecked ship can't be that much different than ours, so I'll know where to look. And if I can just grab a few liters of cryostat fluid, it'll keep Sophie alive long enough for you to do all your scouting and recon.
That's suicide, Ort said.
It's only suicide if there are actually organics, Emmanuel said. And besides, I have a better chance of surviving if it's just me. One person is a lot harder to detect than a whole squad.
No way, Doc, Balma said, standing. If you go, I go. I owe Sophie that much.
Holly pushed herself up from her seat. Give me a rifle and armor. I owe Sophie my life.
We all do. We can't give up on her. She wouldn't give up on us.
Diego and Ort looked at each other.
I don't know about this, Ort said, his deep voice rumbling.
He exhaled slowly.
A scientist, a marine, and a psychologist walk into a crashed NTC ship. There's probably a joke in there somewhere, but the punchline doesn't turn out good for any of them.
Jeff raised his hand from the back of the room, speaking for the first time. I'll go.
Me too,
David chimed in.
Diego folded his arms across his chest and leaned back in his chair.
You know, I've spent a few months on this ship with you people, and I still haven't come to fully appreciate how insane you all are.
Emmanuel waited for the soldier's adamant protest against their actions. He knew it was foolish, crazy even, to think they could save Sophie. But hadn't everything they'd done since the organics attacked been some insane moonshot plan? Surviving in Cheyenne, using the R-Vamps, flying to Mars.
Look, Diego said, pointing to Jeff and David. Those kids are staying put, and so is the psychologist. Doctor, if you want to throw yourself in harm's way, be my guest. But I'd prefer if you didn't. This is a job for armed professionals.
He stood, then gestured to Balma and Ort.
If the whole crew is going to go out there against our better judgment, then I'd be derelict in my duties as an NTC soldier if I let kids go out there. We'll get into that ship today. And we'll get those supplies.
Chapter 4 Captain Noble couldn't get the words out of his mind. The multidimensional alien had spoken to him through some sort of telepathic communication. Or was that just his imagination? He wasn't sure what was real anymore. He'd been isolated for so long that he yearned for any kind of contact. He simply couldn't endure the mental and physical pain of being alone much longer. Sitting with his knees pulled up to his chest, he examined his frail body. His once-defined chest muscles were gone, his chest now nothing more than skin clinging to his ribs. Long, matted hair clung to his chiseled jaw, and he reached up to feel his thinning beard. The coiled cord feeding him nutrients was just barely keeping him alive. He could feel and see himself wasting away. But somewhere inside, he believed he was still alive for a reason. He was one of only a few human survivors. Maybe the only human survivor. This was the first time the thought had crossed his mind, and it chilled him to the core. Billions had perished, and if he was the only person left, then he had to keep fighting. Curling up in a fetal position and dying was not what humans did. He wasn't going to disrespect his species by giving up. Part of him doubted he was the last of his kind, especially after seeing the sunspot launch from Offutt Air Force Base during Operation Redemption. He thought of Dr. Winston and her crew often, wondering if they had made it past the organic defenses on their way to Mars. He wasn't a religious man, but he did find himself praying they reached the NTC colony. Perhaps there was still hope for humanity there. Letting out a sigh, he looked up at Ribbit and then down at Roots. The aliens were both sleeping in their orbs. They too seemed to have a desire to keep living, even in these horrid conditions. He wondered what had happened to their species and their home worlds.
While he hadn't been able to speak to his odd-looking friends, their presence helped ease the sense of loneliness. He imagined it was a lot like how prisoners back on Earth had felt about a pet mouse, cat, or even a plant. Noble crawled across the floor to the other side of his orb and angled his head to look down, past roots, at the hundreds of orbs lining the bulkhead wall. There had to be thousands of prisoners inside the ship. He scanned the chamber, looking for the multidimensional aliens. He'd spent countless hours, days. Hell, he had no idea how much time, waiting for someone to give him some answers. Standing in his orb, he decided to try something different.
"Hey!" he yelled. "Come talk to me again!"
Ribbit and Roots both stirred in their orbs and moved to get a better look at him. Croaking reverberated from above, and a cracking sound came from below as Roots swayed all four branch-like arms.
"Come on! Everyone!" Noble shouted. "Make some noise!"
Other strange voices joined his cry. Screeching, chirps, and what sounded like barking followed, drowning out his own shouts.
"Yeah! That's right. Let's tell these alien freaks who's boss," Noble said.
He held in a breath, exhaled, and then at the top of his lungs screamed,
"Let us out of here!"
The cacophony of ethereal wails and alien voices blended together in a chorus that sent adrenaline rushing through his veins. But the warmth quickly turned to ice when he heard a strangely familiar voice. This time, it wasn't in his head. It sounded human. He wasn't alone after all. There was another human on this ship. He moved over to the edge of his wall, his face so close to it his matted beard stood up from the static electricity generated by the force field, eyes flitting and ears perked. He looked and listened for the source of the voice. Noble pulled on the tube connecting him to the bottom of the orb as he moved around for a better look. But just as he began to scan the western side of the chamber, he saw something that took his breath away. Four sinewy, multidimensional entities sparkled into view. They fanned out in different directions. The dull ringing that followed their presence silenced the prisoners. Everyone but Noble. He shouted louder this time.
"Who's out there? If you can hear me, tell me your name!"
One of the multidimensional entities blinked in and out as it crossed the chamber toward his orb, but the captain wasn't deterred.
"Please!"
he yelled.
"Please tell me your name!"
The only answer was the ringing noise. Every single prisoner remained silent. The presence of the multidimensional overlords had them all spooked. And Noble began to feel the chill of fear as one of them halted outside the blue wall separating him from the black void beyond. He took a step back as it reached out with a blue limb that spun like a drill toward the orb. The wall peeled back, opening a doorway. Cold air rushed into his cell and his hair stood up on his naked flesh. The spinning drill bit solidified into a needle and continued toward his face. Noble took another step back until his spine was dangerously close to the wall of the orb. He held up a hand and moved his head from side to side as the sharp tip spun toward his mouth. "No," he mumbled, rearing his head back. "Please, please, no." The needle jabbed his lips, numbing them instantly. He reached up to swat it away. The multidimensional being pulled it back, replaced the wall, and then vanished from view, leaving Noble standing there in shock. He tried to speak, and then he tried to scream, but no sounds could escape his mouth. There was just a muffled strangle reverberating in his throat. He fell to his knees, reaching up to touch his swollen lips. They were clamped shut. It didn't take long to load one of the 8-wheeled armored rhinos.
Several of the rhinos had been destroyed in the organic attack on the sunspot, and many had scars from where shrapnel had blasted against them. But the vehicles were built tough. A few scratches, a busted wheel or two, and even a shard of spaceship hull through an armor plate wasn't going to stop a rhino. Still, Diego wondered if they could withstand a spider or a sentinel. He hoped they wouldn't have to find out. The interior of the rhino was especially spacious with only Diego, Ord, and Bauma in the vehicle. Diego was glad he'd convinced Emmanuel to stay. This wasn't a place for scientists to play hero. They had brought a portable R-Vamp and enough pulse rifle rounds and EMP grenades for a platoon. That was one benefit of being a small crew on the huge sunspot.
"You know what?" Ort broke the silence between them. "This might be the first time I actually feel like we're fully equipped to engage the organics."
"Equipped or not, I'd rather we didn't see a single one of them," Diego said from the driver's seat. "Those blue bastards are annoying as hell even when you've got an R-Vamp and EMP grenades." Diego wanted to sigh. He thought about the time he would have spent scouting the area and identifying any potential threats. He hated going in blind to a mission. It was just like when he and Sergeant Harrington had volunteered to go with that squad into the Chinese sub back on Earth. They'd gone in with no idea of what they were about to face, holding on to the tenuous hope that they'd find human survivors. But the only survivors that had come back from that mission were him and a few others who had managed to escape demise at the claws of hungry spiders. They'd lost half their search and rescue party with nothing to show for it. The rhino crawled over the barren landscape. Jagged red rocks pushed up all over from the rust-colored dirt like the claws of some giant sentinel yearning to free itself from the planet. They climbed and dipped down hill after hill, carefully crawling toward the location Sonya had told them to mark on their map. Over rocks and small ditches they went. The landscape looked just as Diego had always imagined it, vast, dry, and the color of rust. Out here it wasn't as terraformed as the patches they'd seen from space. The sky, though, looked slightly different than Earth's. There was a purple hue to it, almost as if it was the tail end of a sunset.
"What's the atmo here, Sonya?" Diego asked.
"Oxygen and atmosphere levels are higher than noted in NTC reports from a year ago," Sonya reported. "Still, oxygen levels are sub 1%. Air density is approximately 3% of Earth's."
It wasn't much, but it was something. The sparse terraforming was having an effect. That might mean humanity was actually finding a foothold on this planet. If only the organics didn't have their claws in it first.
"Any contacts?" Diego asked.
"So far, I do not detect any life forms," Sonya said. "However, it is difficult for me to determine with complete certainty that there are no life forms present at our destination. The shielding provided by the landscape and the ship's radio defenses making such determinations exceedingly difficult."
"Understood," Diego replied. "Tell us as soon as you spot something."
They continued across the alien terrain, eyes flitting for hostiles. Stars studded the sky above them. Diego waited for one of those stars to come careening down. Surely some of those jewels in the sky were the organic ships. They were probably waiting up there, distributed around the planet like vultures, ready to plummet down and tear apart the carrion. Each time he thought he saw something move, his heart picked up in tempo and his grip tightened around his rifle. Despite Sonya's reassurances, Diego found trusting the AI difficult. He preferred not to rely solely on computers and electronic sensors. Relying on his own senses and intuition had served him well over the years. It had kept him alive. He scanned the horizon looking for signs of organics. A dark column that looked like a cloud rolled across the horizon. Diego squinted for a better view.
"Sonya, what is that at our 5 o'clock?
"I am detecting a dust storm," she said. "However, it is not currently headed in our direction. Risk assessments indicate that it is not even a mild threat to our current mission. The probability does exist that it might intersect with our path, but it is unlikely.
Unlikely, Diego muttered. He didn't like that there was even a small chance it might hit them. Still, he couldn't help but think that the ominous dust clouds billowing across the horizon were a sign of things to come.
Still don't like seeing them, Hort grumbled.
Me either, Balma said. The dust storms were bad enough on Earth. You can ask Sophie about the one that nearly crashed her helo before she even got to Cheyenne Mountain. I can't imagine what this one would be like.
In my book, Mars's storms are like organics, Diego said. Better left not experienced.
The wind pelted them with gravel and dirt as they continued driving, the vehicle navigating the rugged terrain at a rapid pace. He kept his eye on the storm crossing the plains in the distance.
You are 2.4 kilometers from the crash site, Sonia reported after several quiet minutes. The ship will soon be visible.
The Rhino climbed a hill crowned with jagged boulders. Balma leaned forward in his seat as if that would hold them steady. Beyond the boulders, they spotted a large valley. Huge gouges were dug into the dirt, leading to the crashed biosphere ship. And it wasn't alone. There were times Diego had doubted his faith. Since the organics had invaded Earth, there wasn't a single day he didn't wonder if God was just a fairy tale humans told themselves to make peace with their inevitable deaths. All the Sunday masses and NTC chaplains' sermons he had attended never mentioned anything about giant monsters descending on Earth from the stars. Other times, he thought maybe he was already dead. Maybe God did exist. And so did heaven and hell. Because right now, he was pretty sure he was in hell.
Holy shit, Ort said over the suit's comms.
Ain't nothing holy about it. Diego stood and pressed one hand against the windshield. The biosphere ship they'd tracked down looked as if it had skidded across the landscape. It looked mostly intact, except for a few huge singe marks that marred its stern. Many of the windows had been blown out near those blackened areas, but otherwise it was in one piece. The same couldn't be said for the multitude of other ships in the area. They, too, had half buried themselves in this spaceship graveyard. Most were just pieces of broken hull, nothing but metal ribbing like the charred skeletons from a pod of gigantic whales.
A graveyard, Balma said quietly.
Wonder what happened to them. Hort murmured.
Diego adjusted his grip on his rifle.
Let's go find out.
Athena thought about returning to look for Walker's body, but she knew by now there wouldn't be much, if anything, left of him. The spiders never wasted anything. She needed to keep her mind on moving forward. If Alexia was correct, they might have transportation to a military installation where other survivors were holed up. A dangerous emotion crept up on her as she walked. Hope was something she tried not to feel, something she tried her best to keep suppressed. For the first time in weeks, she embraced the emotion. Maybe it wasn't such a bad thing after all. Perhaps this was what she needed to keep things going. She brought up her pulse rifle to scope the skyline for drones or alien ships. Lowering her rifle, she craned her helmet to look over the city one last time. She had managed to evade the spiders after connecting with Alexia, but the beasts were still out there. Hunting. Movement flashed across the exterior of a building a few blocks into the city. Several of the spiders were clambering across the white walls between the window frames. She crouched out of sight and scanned the dry seabed in front of her once more. The rolling tan dunes and blue sky revealed no sign of hostiles.
Goodbye, Walker,
she whispered. In her mind's eye, she pictured the monsters still feeding on Walker's remains. Athena suppressed the thought and set off down the beach. There were 4 miles of sand between herself and the GOA, all of which would leave her exposed. At a jog, it would take her just under 40 minutes in the armored suit. She spotted the bones of the whale carcass she had sheltered in with Walker, but aside from that, there wasn't much. The sun was already going down. a harsh reminder that the aliens that had killed Corporal Marlin were out there, somewhere. With only an hour or so of sunlight left, she couldn't waste time.
4 miles. That's all you have to do,
she reminded herself. She pushed her legs from a jog to a run. Sweat prickled across her shoulders and down her back, her skin sticking to the membrane under the armor. Even with the coolant circulating through the suit, she was burning up. The filtered air in her helmet was getting stale and gritty, and each steamy breath irritated her overexerted lungs. Her eyes flitted from the skyline to her HUD, scanning for hostiles and the data rolling across the display in the upper right-hand corner. The temperature was starting to drop, now that the sun was going down, but it was still up at 118 degrees. Wind gusted across the plateau of sand, rustling the surface and exposing the bones of fish and empty shells of crabs and other crustaceans. Athena used her tongue to pull the straw in her helmet to her lips. She took a sip, the cool liquid soothing her dry throat. The heat was starting to make her lightheaded. The adrenaline from seeing Walker die and hiding from the spiders had long since waned, leaving her with little energy. She forced her boots forward. The air undulated from the heat, filling the horizon with the facade of movement. The mirage made it difficult to see if anything was moving beyond the tan-colored terrain. She managed to run the first 2 miles without stopping to rest, but slowed at the halfway point to sip more water and crouch next to a cluster of large rocks. The boulders provided some shelter from the fading sun. She rested her back against the smooth rock to catch her breath. Instead of breathing through her nostrils, she took air through her mouth. The heat wasn't as bad on her throat as it was her sensitive nose. After a few seconds of rest, she scoped the cracked seabed between her position and that of the GOA with her pulse rifle. There was no sign of life. Her HUD confirmed the sky was clear, so she continued onward at a jog. The membrane in her suit clung to her sweaty flesh now, making it more challenging to move. She thought of her crew back in the submarine and anticipated their questions. Everyone would want to know what happened to Walker. How he died. Why he died. What the plan was. All she wanted to do was climb into her bunk and close her eyes. But leaders didn't get to rest. She focused back on the stretch of sand on the other side of a rolling hill. She remembered this area from a previous scouting mission. Ravines snaked across the terrain here. Walker and she had stumbled upon it 3 weeks ago on accident when returning to the GOA. Athena changed direction, moving south past the canyons. They were deep enough the sun didn't penetrate the bottom. From an aerial view, she imagined they looked like yawning, bloody slash marks on flesh with their red edges. Thoughts of the beasts that might dwell in those shadows kept her far from the edges of the gorges. Her eyes roved over the landscape out of habit, but she had to continue pushing herself to run. Every movement was uncomfortable now. Her muscles were stretched to the limit and her lungs were on fire. Her jog devolved into more of a staggering hobble, and she cradled her rifle over her chest, doing her best not to let it clank against the armor. She hadn't gone far beyond the gorges when she heard the unmistakable rumble of an organic spaceship. Instinct forced her to the ground, and she looked skyward. Not a drone this time, a two-winged aircraft with a dorsal fin cut over the horizon like a barracuda. It veered toward Los Angeles, probably to check out reports from the aliens about her and Walker. She hadn't seen one of these aircraft for weeks, and it was bad news for her. If she was spotted, she knew the pilot wouldn't capture her. It would kill her in a volley of laser fire. There wouldn't be anything left for her crew to find if that happened. Keeping low to the ground, she gazed longingly in the direction of the GOA. She was less than half a mile away, but there was no way she would make it. Besides, she didn't want to lead the aliens to their hideout. Her only chance was to return to the ravines and take shelter there until the ship was gone. A moment later, she was up on her feet and running toward the deep cuts in the seabed. She focused on the closest ravine, which appeared about as wide as a one-lane road. The roar of the alien ship droned on, and she snuck a glance to see it circling Los Angeles, scanning for targets. She wasn't sure how far the pilots could see, or what type of scanning equipment they had, but she had a feeling it would snag her eventually. She had to get out of the open. A glance over her shoulder showed the fighter was already changing course. The adrenaline returned, warming her veins and nerves as she sprinted toward the ravine ahead. The rumble of the aircraft grew louder and louder with every step she took until the very ground beneath her feet was shaking. It felt like it was almost on her now. She clicked the rifle into its slot at her back and prepared to jump into the gorge. It wasn't as wide as the others, maybe 12 feet across, but that didn't mean it wasn't deep. If she fell all the way to the bottom, she would break a bone, perhaps several. A broken bone out here would be worse than getting vaporized by the lasers. At least those would kill her instantly. She waited until she was a few steps away before launching herself into the air. The craggy brown far wall reached out to meet her as she plummeted. She slammed against the rock, her boots landing on a rocky shelf. Her right hand grappled for purchase, and her left slid down the jagged rock, which sliced into her glove. Another swipe with her right hand, and she managed to find a handhold, relief washing through after finding purchase. Panting and hugging the wall, she slowly looked down at the outline of the floor, some 50 or 60 feet below. The alien fighter passed overhead, stirring the sand above into a vortex that rained down into the gorge and peppered her with grit and tiny rocks. She held her position until she heard the craft coming in for another pass. The thump, thump of laser fire pounded the seabed above her, shaking away hunks of rock and sand all around her. The blasts hit the ground somewhere above her, several cutting through the air right above the ravine, sizzling and tossing up sand. Her boots were planted firmly on a rocky shelf, and she had a good grip on a deposit of jutting rock, but if any of it gave way, she would plunge a hell of a long way down. She searched for a way to climb deeper. As the fighter circled for another pass, she began moving, carefully negotiating the wall. The rays of penetrating sunlight weakened with every new foot and handhold she found. She descended into the darkness as the aircraft came in for a second pass. Laser fire pounded the seabed with such force that a huge section of rock and sand fell away and smashed to the ground below. Twisting her body, she avoided the rock slide with mere inches to spare. She was over halfway down when the fighter came in yet another time, peppering the ground above. More grit and rocks rained down, covering her in dust and sand. When she was just 10 feet from the bottom, she jumped the rest of the way. Her boots crunched into the sand, and she rolled. Recovering, she grabbed her pulse rifle and crouched down to look at whatever she had landed on. The air seized in her lungs, and fresh adrenaline charged through her vessels. The floor wasn't sand or rock. It was a pile of bones, mostly small fish and the shells of crustaceans, but there were several larger sea creatures. Dozens of shark skeletons lay over in the corner. Seeing remains like this wasn't abnormal, but seeing them dragged together like this was highly unusual. Something had killed these creatures and feasted on them in the early days of the invasion, leaving their bones in the once underwater grave. She was in the den of some aquatic alien apex predator, hiding in one of their nests. Even if abandoned, terrified her to the core. Her blood chilled at the memories of the aquatic aliens she had seen from inside the submarine. Had this been one of those? She swallowed as the fighter passed overhead again. The pilot had stopped firing the laser, but apparently continued to search for her. Breathing heavily, she lay down on the bones, her heart thundering. The sun retreated beyond the lip of the gorge, leaving darkness to cover the land. Stars already pinpricked the sky. She had to get out of there and back to the GOA. Her opportunity finally came a few minutes later when the roar of the fighter diminished into a dull rumble and then quiet. The ringing in her ears ceased and silence filled the ravine. She could hear her beating heart in the quiet. Another minute passed before she started climbing. Her biceps and quads felt like they were going to tear.
Come on, Athena. You got this.
Halfway up, she rewarded herself with a drink from the straw, but it took a deep suck to get even a few drops. Her bottle was dry. She pulled herself onto the rocky ledge she had first landed on. The top was almost within reach. She caught her breath on the ledge, letting her muscles relax and listening for hostiles above ground. Hearing nothing, she finally pulled herself back out onto the seabed, squirming over the top and then pushing herself up on two knees. Twilight had long since set in. She set off for the GOA, but just a few steps from the ravine she heard a low rumble that made her heart skip a beat. She froze. A scan of the sky revealed no glowing spaceships. She took another step, then realized
The sound was coming from the ground beneath her feet. It rose to an out-of-tune whistle. Athena slowly turned to look out over the ravines. The slashes were all glowing blue. Light pulsated like strobes across terrain pockmarked black from laser fire. Corporal Marlin's final words surfaced in her memories. The seabed is blue again. It's blue. All of it. Glowing blue. She did what she had become very good at. She turned and ran. Chapter 5 Bauma stared out the rhino's front windows at the skeletal remains of the ship graveyard, wishing that just one of these ships was intact. But no, most of them were reduced to scaffolding and bulkheads. There would be no supplies for them to scavenge here, much less viable cryostat fluid to keep Sophie alive. Their only hope was in the biosphere ship they'd tracked down. At least it was still mostly in one piece, its jagged edges belying the curving domes of the biomes toward its stern. A few portholes had been blown out, and there were long scrapes, some that might have penetrated the corridors running through the ship. Otherwise, there were no gaping wounds, giving them hope they'd find the supplies they were searching for. Bauma read the huge block white letters scrawled across its side where they had stopped. "Radiant Dawn," he said. "Not looking so radiant anymore. Sonya, life forms?" "Maybe," the AI replied.
"Maybe," Ort rumbled. "We're right outside this Radiant Dawn, and the best you can give us is a maybe?"
"While it is true you are within visual range," Sonya said, "the rhino does not have the same sensor array as the sunspot. My detection abilities are limited to the hardware provided by the rhino as relayed to the sunspot. Unfortunately, despite your proximity to the Radiant Dawn, the canyon and the Radiant Dawn's radiation shielding is blocking me from any improvement in detecting potential life forms."
Diego secured his helmet. "If we're not staking out here for a few days, there's only one way to see if there are life forms on that ship." Bauma took a second to look at his comrades. He'd come to know Ord and Diego personally over the past few months, and he knew their service record, but they hadn't actually served in combat together, besides their brief skirmish on Earth to get aboard the sunspot. It wasn't anything like the long history he'd had fighting beside Sergeant Overton. "Had to go and sacrifice yourself, Sarge," Bauma thought. "I could really use you right now. But you didn't go to war with the army you wanted. Or in this case, squad. You went to war with the one you had." Right now, Bauma had two guys who were already skeptical about the way Emmanuel had been running the crew. They weren't used to being under the command of scientists. Hell, it had taken Bauma some time to get used to it, but the eggheads had grown on him. Ort and Diego had served under Captain Noble, so they had to be worth something. Bauma was sure they were good men. Still, that didn't make working cohesively with them that much easier. They hadn't really gotten used to watching each other's backs, and they had none of the ties you forged in battle with your brothers in arms. None of the half-psychic intuition you developed when you knew someone's instincts and reactions and they knew yours. At least not yet.
"Guess there's always trial by fire," Bauma muttered. "What's that?" Diego asked. "Ready to get the hell out there," Bauma said. "Good," Diego said. "Get in and get out. Ammo on this mission is stealth and speed."
"Full copy," Ort said.
His frame took up the entire doorway of the rhino.
"Just say the word, LT."
Bauma watched Diego gaze out over the morbid tableau. He hadn't had to follow another soldier's order since Sergeant Overton. This was going to be interesting.
"Move!"
Diego gestured out the door of the rhino. The trio filtered through the wreckage of the other ships toward the Radiant Dawn. Wind carrying clouds of dust rushed over them, howling and biting at their armor. The dust clung to Bauma's visor, and he was forced to wipe it clean a couple times before they even made it to the Dawn. Once they reached the forward hatch of the ship, they pressed their bodies against the hull.
Sonya, can you get us in?
Diego asked.
I should be able to if you can get me a hard connection.
Easy, Diego said. He unlatched a panel near the hatch and stuck a network probe from his suit into the security port. A moment later, the hatch spiraled open. There was no whoosh of air outward like Balma had expected.
With all those broken windows and scars in the hull, it's no wonder they lost.